You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Barton Gellman won the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for a series of revealing articles he wrote about Vice President Dick Cheney for the Washington Post, and now he's expanded those articles into a book called Angler, The Cheney Vice Presidency. It's published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Barton Gellman to this program today. Hello.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, you began covering Dick Cheney when he was in the Pentagon. Has he changed much over the years?
He has certainly changed in his public image, and he's changed in the way he operates. And part of that is that in all his previous jobs, he was serving another president. He was chief of staff who subordinated himself. He was secretary of defense to a very, you know, sort of moderate Republican. And now two things have changed. He has a president who is much more radical and who gives him a lot of rope. And also, he himself is now an independent constitutional officer and feels unbound by a staffer's role.
And you write that he shifted America's course more than any terrorist could have done.
Well, I think that's true. People like to say that everything changed on 9/11. And if you look at just the raw statistics of it, you have a great tragedy, but no greater in terms of loss of life than Hurricane Katrina, no greater economic impact than several other events in the last few years. What really changed was the way our government interacts with our society and overseas.
And he didn't really want to do much after Hurricane Katrina. In fact, he kind of discouraged action. So he picks and chooses. Many people have remarked that he's the most powerful vice president in U.S. history. But didn't that the possibility grow in part from an executive order that President Clinton signed?
Well, one element of his power, not insignificant and not well known, is his influence over regulation. And Clinton, with Al Gore in mind, put the vice president in charge of a review body that had to sign off on major new regulations. Bush did two things, and it's fascinating here. He gave more power to that review process in the White House.
It was Executive Order 12-866, and he's amended it.
Twice. And the other thing he did was he took out all explicit references to the vice president, because Cheney is a stealth kind of operator. He still runs the thing, but nowhere does it say so.
Well, do you think that it means that future vice presidents, whether it's Joe Biden or Sarah Palin, will be inheriting that kind of power?
In some cases, they'll be inheriting the form of the power. Whether they'll be inheriting the content is another thing, but most of Cheney's power was not because it was written down somewhere. It was because of a unique combination of personality, skills, events, and his own extraordinary ability to operate.
And you write that Vice President Cheney's most troubling quality was a sense of mission so acute that it drove him to seek power without limit. That's something that we probably won't see in a future vice president because of the fallout from Dick Cheney.
Well, Dick Cheney became a laugh line in Republican debates during the primaries. Sometimes just the question made a Republican audience laugh. John McCain was asked whether he would have a vice president like that, and he said a vice president's major job is to check daily on the health of the president.
You write that President Bush and Vice President Cheney reached a meeting of minds for different reasons entirely. How different are Bush and Cheney's worldviews and personalities?
Well, in lots of cases, Cheney is pushing on an open door, as Dan Bartlett, the president's political counselor, told me. If you come to the president and say, you really ought to have complete control over this and that area, as commander-in-chief, no one should question you. That sounds pretty good to a guy sitting behind the desk in the Oval Office. But Bush is a much more of a gut politician. He's a big picture. He's a visionary guy. For example, in terms of different reasons, the Iraq War for Bush ended up being about spreading democracy. And for Cheney, it was about balance of power and demonstrating to potential enemies that they better not mess with us.
In fact, he chose Iraq because he thought it would be the easiest of our enemies to defeat. He didn't think that Iraq was the most dangerous country out there.
Well, that's interesting. It's something I suspected, but I couldn't know until I started talking to some of his senior foreign policy advisors. And in the book, they lay out on the record how he came to think about this. And he did not actually believe that Iraq was the greatest, most imminent danger. As you say, he wanted to send a signal, and Iran, North Korea were bridges too far.
Now, you said that the president is a big picture guy, but didn't Cheney act as an information gatekeeper to the president? So you can only come up with a big picture with the information that's available to you.
Well, there's a question of ends and a question of means. Bush knew where he wanted to go in broad terms, but you know, God is in the details. You have to figure out how you'll implement it. And Cheney reached down much further than vice presidents have done before to shape which options would go to the president and which ones wouldn't.
You have gotten into newspapers with the other, you know, people have found this really interesting about how Dick Cheney even became the vice presidential candidate. He was in charge of the Bush Vice Presidential Search Committee in 2000, and he wound up getting himself selected. We've heard a lot about the vetting processes for vice presidents lately, but how much vetting did Cheney go through?
Well, that's fascinating. Very little. Look, it's been
didn't he vet everybody else really with a very, very complicated and difficult questionnaire?
Well, that's exactly it. There have been jokes for a long time about Cheney choosing himself, and he didn't choose himself. Bush did. But Cheney designed the most intrusive, invasive process of scrutinizing other candidates that's ever been done. And when the switcheroo was pulled and it became Dick Cheney who was going to be the running mate, he did not fill out his own questionnaire. The doctor who vouched for his cardiac health had never met him or reviewed his medical records and so on down the line. That's Denton Cooley. He's a very well-known heart surgeon in Houston.
And Halliburton refused to provide any information as well. And he also, you say, is accused by some of undermining other candidates' chances. He wanted to be vice president.
Right. Well, Frank Keating was governor of Oklahoma. He was widely described as being on the short list for vice president. In fact, Cheney told Keating, "You're on the short list." A very short list, he said. And he filled out the questionnaire, and later, some embarrassing information that was actually a distortion of his answers made its way to Newsweek. Keating tells the story for the first time and at some length of why he believes Dick Cheney is responsible. He says, "Cheney coming into my life has been like a black cloud." And the fascinating thing is it's not only him. John Engler, who was governor of Michigan, another very close ally of Bush, says to me again on the record, he thinks Keating's right. It must have been Cheney.
Barton Gellman is the author of Angler, The Cheney Vice Presidency, which is published by Penguin Press. He has an interesting way of operating if he wants something done. He works through surrogates and allies in different departments, but nobody knows the complete picture other than his assistant, David Addington?
Well, two people were crucial to him in his office, Scooter Libby and David Addington, one the chief of staff and national security advisor, the other his counsel. And he prefers to work behind the scenes without anyone knowing his role. And he prefers, in fact, that the decision be made before people who might disagree know there's a decision to be made. So he won a lot of battles, especially in the first term, without the other side showing up.
Can you tell us about how the vice president intervened on a water rights issue on the California-Oregon border and why you think he cared so much about something like that?
There was a drought out west in the Klamath Valley. And here, by the way, the book relies heavily on information that was developed for the newspaper series with Joe Becker, my partner. There was a big fight between Native American tribes, farmers and fishermen, because there was only so much water to go around. The law and the science were on the side of the fishermen and the Native Americans. The politics and the economics were on the side of the farmers, the ranchers. Cheney intervened very hard with no fingerprints at all and overturned the science and overturned the what appeared to be a firm legal requirement so that his potential allies in a swing state had been within 0.5% of going the other way in the 2000 election, his guys got the water.
Simply a political decision?
I wouldn't say simply political. And first of all, I'm not on the inside of his head, but I know that something else he cared about a lot besides the politics, and he did care about the politics, he said so internally, was it was a Westerner's gut antipathy to regulation. Not many East Coast folks understand that there are 13 states out west in which the federal government owns half of the land, and people out there just get sick of the idea that some bureaucrat in Washington is going to decide their fate.
But it's so odd that this man who comes across as a control freak would be somebody who'd be against regulation.
Well, he wants to be in charge of what he wants to be in charge of, but he is fairly pure, hands-off, free market guy when it comes to economic decisions and environmental regulation.
How long has David Addington been working with Cheney?
Well, very long time. Cheney first met him back in the early mid-80s when Cheney was a senior member of Congress and sitting on the investigating committee to look into the Iran-Contra scandal. And he was a principal author, and Addington played a big role in the dissent from that committee's report. Their position was that Ronald Reagan, probably for prudential reasons, should not have done this transaction where he armed the Contras secretly with money and tried to broker a deal with Iran and so on. He said it may not have been a good idea, but it was the president who was in the right. Congress was wrong to try to write a law telling him he couldn't do it.
And this has been pretty much the way Dick Cheney has seen presidential power ever since, maybe even before, probably going back to the Nixon years.
He has a sincere and principled view of the Constitution. He's sometimes accused of not caring about the Constitution. I think that's all wrong. What he cares about is a view of the Constitution which is at the far extreme of a long-running debate over executive versus legislative power.
And they are champions of the unitary executive theory.
Unitary executive means two things to them, although they don't tend to use the slogan. But Cheney and Addington believe two things. One is that because the Constitution vests the executive power in the president, that's the very beginning of Article II, that means that any effort by executive agencies, say the Environmental Protection Agency, to look for some kind of independence from White House control is misguided. It's unitary. The president's in charge of all of it. The other is anything to do with executive power can't be touched by the courts or the Congress. There's been a long-standing consensus view that although we call it separation of powers, that really it's a system of overlapping shared powers, and he doesn't buy that.
But during the Watergate hearings, Richard Nixon invoked executive privilege to try to keep a lot of things secret, and he lost again and again and again. Is Dick Cheney saying that things have changed since the Nixon years?
There was a series of cases which went against Cheney's view of executive authority, but he and Addington simply believe they were wrongly decided. And he also believes that it is a luxury we can't afford at a time of such great threats to put any kind of shackles on the president.
So did they see September 11th as an opportunity to reverse the way things had been proceeding?
It would be a little bit too glib to say it was only an opportunity. I think September 11th was an opportunity for Cheney, but it was also a ratification of his view in his own mind that these much greater executive powers were urgently needed.
You say that the vice president's office in Addington sat out the debate over the Patriot Act because they didn't feel it was necessary?
That would surprise a lot of people that the Patriot Act did not interest them as much, because that is asking Congress to tell the executive what it can and can't do and asking Congress for permission. And his view was that most of what the president needed to do, he could and should do simply on his own say-so.
My guest is Barton Gellman, special projects reporter at The Washington Post. He and Joe Becker won a 2008 Pulitzer Prize and a George Polk Award and the Goldsmith Prize for investigative reporting for their series on the vice president. Now Mr. Gellman has expanded that into a book called Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency, published by the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after this. Later in this hour, Lynn Ullman, the novelist daughter of Liv Ullman and Ingmar Bergman, on her latest, set on a tiny island in the Baltic. And then in our second hour, the life and work of the great German Renaissance artist Albrecht Dürer, and New York Times reporter and war correspondent Dexter Filkins talks about working in Afghanistan and Iraq since 1998. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Now our entire show is available as a podcast. We're back with Barton Gellman, winner of the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for a series of articles he wrote with Joe Becker on Vice President Cheney. Now, a book without Joe Becker. I don't know what happened to her. It's called Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency, published by Penguin Press. And it's been making headlines because even though it confirms a lot of things that we have heard rumors about or read kind of about in over the past years, this is the book that ties everything down. You really got people to talk. Did people want to talk about him?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. It's a complicated, long process. And what I find, and it's quite irritating because it makes it hard for me to do my work, is that, I don't know, 50% or more of the good information I get comes at the very end. And so if you were to look in the endnotes on this thing, a book that's here in the stores in September, so many of the great interviews, so many of the important people agreed to go on the record in May, sometimes June.
Well, that's probably because they now see the administration in a different light than they did before, one that most people will consider to have been a failure, and they just want to tell their story.
Well, for some of those people, that turn had come years before. The problem with persuading people to go on the record is they're not sure what percentage they see for themselves in that. And it's only when I've gone around the circle a number of times and have accumulated most of the picture that they say, well, now I guess I'd better put my own voice in there. Besides which, there are people who say, even then, I don't want to do it. And my pitch to them is, if you consider your work to have been public service, it didn't end the day you cleared your desk. Public service includes making sure we know what happened, what went wrong, and what the lessons are.
And some of them damned the vice president. Some gave you a mixed message. They thought he was right here and wrong there.
There are a lot of people who admire him, and there are many admirable qualities in the guy. He has worked enormously hard. I found no reason to think there are any venal motives or any hypocrisy, personal ambition. He is right out there up front with what he believes, and he is principled to an extreme that a lot of his own people now think was damaging to the country.
How much was it him and how much of it was David Addington? The things we're talking about mostly involve David Addington, not Scooter Libby. But was it David Addington who was responsible for the order which stripped suspected terrorists of access to any court, civilian or military, domestic or foreign? Or was he just acting on the vice president's behalf?
There's an old and very well-rehearsed dance that goes on between Cheney and his very closest aides. And I talked to a number of people, including, say, Jack Goldsmith at the Justice Department, who said that he wondered for a while, how much is this Addington acting alone? And he concluded, once he started spending some time with Cheney also, that Addington was a perfect agent for Cheney, that there was a complete meeting of the minds about what to do and how to do it.
What role did Addington play in the creation of the military commissions? And was there any historical precedent for what he was proposing?
Well, the problem was this. The United States was at war in Afghanistan, was starting to pick up people on the battlefield, and as well was trying to find al-Qaeda members around the world. What do you do with them? You can't just shoot them. You can't just let them go. You might not have evidence that fits a normal criminal legal trial, and in fact, they were very much disposed not to try that. So there was an interagency group to try to figure out how to solve this problem. Every major agency had a voice in it. Cheney and Addington already knew what they wanted, and they just went behind the group, and they wanted commissions because they are entirely done by the president and executive, and there was a president, which was back in World War II.
When we interned Japanese Americans.
Actually, not that president. The president was military commissions. That FDR, there were certain German saboteurs who came ashore, and FDR created these commissions to try and execute them. The problem is, for Cheney and Addington, that since then there had been decades of intervening law, Geneva Conventions and Uniform Code of Military Justice and lots of other things that made the FDR president not so relevant anymore.
And there's also been, there have been histories written in which it's suggested that injustice was done in some of those military commissions against the captured Germans. Not all of them really were guilty of very much, but that's a whole other matter. Do we know what the president's thoughts were on the military commissions? Was he in the loop?
This is one where I could not penetrate the black box, but what I can write about is the inputs and the outputs. What I know is that that Cheney walks into lunch one day with an order in his hand that David Addington has written and that almost no one else has seen. He walks out of lunch, still carrying it, and he hands it off. And within an hour, this thing has traversed a circuit around the West Wing in which it changes hands so many times, nobody knows Cheney had any role in it. And at the end of an hour, it's back in the Oval Office for Bush's signature. Bush is expecting it. He signs without reading, and the deal is done before anyone else knows it. Colin Powell picks up the phone and asks the guy he thought was in charge of this, what the hell just happened?
Well, you write any number of times of people being kept out of the loop, including some of the most important figures in the administration, Condoleezza Rice, Tom Ridge, Robert Mueller, and President Bush, more often than not. So this was a whole separate unit that was operating independently, with the documents being kept in David Addington's office?
Well, what you're talking about now is the domestic surveillance by the National Security Agency.
That's what I was introducing. But it seems to me that we see again and again the president out of the loop, or other people we'd expect to know about operations, not knowing that anything was going on. My guest is Barton Gellman, who's written Angler, the Cheney Vice Presidency, published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. I'm going to quote, you write that after 9/11, David Addington and other administration officials like John Woo and Timothy Flanagan wrote and classified a new legal framework that was meant to be invisible, unreviewable, its very existence unknown by legislative or judicial actors who might push back. Why do you think there was such an emphasis on secrecy in that time after 9/11, when, as some have argued, the administration was getting a blank check from Congress for pretty much everything that it proposed?
Well, there are multiple motives for secrecy, some of them quite honorable. They're in lots of cases, Cheney is taking a principle or an idea that would win wide support and taking it to an extreme, overreaching in a way that blows that support. And so they didn't want to ask for legislation, in part because they didn't want to say the president needed permission from anyone. Part of it is we're talking about highly classified national security material that for good reason is secret.
But do you think they were also felt at times that they were crossing the line because the controversial interpretations of executive power that John Yoo made? I'm sure they understood that if it reached the Justice Department or some other place, that it would probably be challenged by some of the top lawyers.
Oh, they did know that, and it was a major part of the motive to keep things secret. After all, they were keeping things away from people who were cleared for the highest classified information. They didn't want opposition. They were contemptuous of what Addington calls interagency treaties, which tend to bring you the least common denominator when what the executive needs is dispatch, swiftness, and willingness to go the extra mile.
Who conceived the domestic surveillance program that went into operation on October 6th, 2001?
I would have to say this is very likely the first intelligence operation that was conceived, created, and overseen by a vice president. Cheney called in George Tenet at the CIA and later Mike Hayden at the NSA and said, tell me what you could be doing that you aren't already doing. And Hayden has this diagram he draws which says, here's what we'd like to do, here's what we actually have the means to do, and here's what's legal. And we operate where they all intersect. And Cheney said, well, tell me what you would do if you took away that legal oval. Now, he wasn't saying do something illegal. He was saying, let's suppose you had no constraints. And then he set about trying to free him of those constraints.
After the existence of the program was disclosed by the New York Times, didn't the White House say its purpose was to monitor terrorists it knew were in the country? But that was already breaking the law, wasn't it?
Well, you know, this remains controversial to some extent, but the bottom line is that there were two unambiguous statutes passed by Congress that were the law of the land and said that it was a felony crime to do this kind of surveillance if one of the parties is in the United States. They hate the term domestic surveillance. Hayden has this folksy metaphor. He says, I've never boarded a domestic flight and landed in Waziristan. It sounds good, but the fact is the law said if either end of that flight was in the United States, you had to have a warrant. And they set about casting that aside.
Because they were, they say, trying to determine if people were terrorists and there was no other way to do it.
Well, they actually had a slightly different take on it. What they said, what Bush said publicly is, if you're on the phone to al-Qaeda, we want to know why. Now, that wasn't actually what the program was doing. Nobody would challenge surveillance of someone who's on the phone to al-Qaeda. They were trying to find out whether someone might be a risk, and almost all the time, the answer was no.
But as we said earlier, the president was kept out of the loop about this program until fairly late, and Condoleezza Rice didn't know. Tom Ridge, who was the head of Homeland Security, did Robert Mueller know?
Bob Mueller knew about it, and Rice actually did know about it. Cheney went to Bush very early, asked for permission to do this. What Bush didn't know was that 18 months later, it became deeply controversial, and the Justice Department started changing its mind, and new people said, those John Yoo opinions are just wrong, and we think some of what you're doing here is illegal. Cheney spent 3 months trying to put down that rebellion before the president ever found out, and he found out almost too late to avoid a complete meltdown of the executive branch.
It was called the Vice President's Special Program.
That was sometimes the informal name. Look, there's a guy named John Bellinger. He was the chief national security lawyer for the White House. This was in the center of his area of responsibility. They kept him out of it because Addington saw him as a kind of weak-kneed liberal practically, even though he always worked for Republicans. And Bellinger, because of the work he does, runs across all kinds. He's meeting people in the hallway. They say, well, you're coming to the meeting this afternoon. And he says, what meeting? And, oh, yeah, sorry, that's the vice president's special program. So Bellinger one day was fed up with it. He walked into Addington's office, confronted him, said, what's all this I'm hearing? Addington says to him, I'm not going to confirm or deny whether there is or isn't such a program, but if there were, you better go tell your little friends at the FBI and CIA to shut up.
Well, he often sounds like a bully. He screams at people, and they tend to back down, don't they?
Well, he's a true believer. He is exceptionally well versed in the law and history of these programs. He is physically a large man. He is contemptuous of opposition, and he's speaking for a very powerful vice president.
After the existence of the warrantless wiretapping program was revealed in the New York Times, Mr. Cheney said that it had saved thousands of lives. Do we have any idea whether that's true?
There is no evidence that's true. In some ways, you would be unsurprised that we don't know everything about the evidence on a classified program, but both Mike Hayden, who was then at the NSA, and Bob Mueller at the FBI, who was very much involved in this program, said privately that they did not believe the vice president was accurate.
You've learned new things about the visit to John Ashcroft's hospital room. That really was a crisis moment for both sides in this story, wasn't it?
It was a crisis moment, and the hospital room visit became well known when Jim Comey testified about it in 2007. What I develop in a very lengthy narrative over two chapters in this book is that the crisis both began earlier and peaked later than we previously thought. And there's a just stunning moment when Jim Comey, the acting attorney general, because Ashcroft is in the hospital, is called into the Oval Office. And this is a day after Bush signed a document over the express objections of the Justice Department. And Comey is intending to leave government that day. And Bush says, look, I want your support on this thing. And anyway, it's kind of a foul to bring up your objections here at the last minute, day before the deadline. Comey can't believe the president thinks that after 3 months of controversy. And so he tells the president, you're being misled. And then he tells the president something that stuns George Bush. He says, Mr. President, I think you ought to know that the FBI director is going to resign today. And Bush had no idea. Now, Cheney knew, Andy Card knew, but Bush truly was out of the loop here.
And you asked Andy Card, why hadn't he told the president? He said, well, I was waiting for the penultimate moment. I don't know what that means.
It was hard to know what that means. Look, in the abstract, Card is perfectly right to say you don't want to put everything in the president's plate. It's appropriate for people to do things at lower levels until the penultimate moment. He wouldn't say what that was. But I think it's safe to say that by the time they realized they were not going to be able to sort of back down the Justice Department, it was pretty late to be telling Bush, well, by the way, for 3 months now, we've known there was a big problem here.
Well, in the end, Bush sided with the Justice Department. And was that the first time that he really went against Dick Cheney?
It was not the first time he went against Dick Cheney. Part of Cheney is a very powerful man, but there's a sort of secret history of the Bush administration that I develop here in which Cheney does lose battles we don't know about. However, this was the most important turning point in the Bush-Cheney relationship. The president found out that Cheney could put him in real danger, could just about walk him off a cliff, because you have to picture this, and it's not just me saying so. It's the president's closest political advisors, such as Dan Bartlett, saying so. If there had been a mass exodus from the FBI, Justice Department, and even a few people at the CIA over a matter of principle, in fact, over a matter in which they believed the president was breaking the law, that would have been like unto the Saturday Night Massacre back under Nixon, and it would have destroyed Bush's presidency.
Has Dick Cheney lost power as a result of this? Has he been less powerful, in fact, since the re-election in 2004?
In broad terms, the answer is yes. It's never that simple in complex relationships and organizations, but there is sort of a trajectory that the book describes of his vice presidency in which he has an early, very powerful period where he's making things happen. And later, Bush knows more, becomes more confident, sees that Cheney can put him in trouble sometimes, and Cheney no longer has the power to drive policy so much as he does to put the brakes on when people are trying to undo his previous work.
And was he also hurt by the revelations about the leak of Valerie Plame Wilson's CIA connection?
That was devastating to Cheney on many levels. It made him and his office look terribly devious, and it lost him.
They were terribly devious.
Well, look, what the evidence that comes out makes it very clear that even though Scooter Libby was not the first to blow the identity of Valerie Plame, he and Cheney were the ones who were determined to get that out.
You say that the vice president wears his low ratings like a medal.
It's a peculiar thing for an elected official. He is not only indifferent to public opinion, except where it has tactical value, he verges on contempt for the ability of the general public to understand the problems, set a rational course, and stick to it. Public opinion to him is fickle, emotional, contradictory, and he believes that only history can judge him.
We don't have time to get into some of the other things you deal with here, like the Detainee Treatment Act, the Military Commissions Act, his thoughts about succession, so many things, Katrina, whatever. But it's a fascinating book, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to want to read it, called Angler, The Cheney Vice Presidency, published by the Penguin Press. My great thanks to Barton Gellman for being my guest today.
Thank you.
And Barton Gellman will be speaking and signing books on Wednesday, October 1st at 7 p.m. at the Upper West Side Barnes & Noble store that's at Broadway and 82nd Street. Up next, Lynn Ullman on her new novel, A Blessed Child, or A Blessed Child. I'll find out which. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.